As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
The race is on, and Ferrari driver Carlos Sainz topped the second day of pre-season testing in Bahrain, but it still appears to be advantage Red Bull, with Sergio Perez setting an ominous pace. But has the competitive order become any clearer, and why is the dreadfully named RB V-Carbo 1 attracting some attention? I'm Ed Straw, and joining me to explain all are Scott Mitchell-Mal and Samarth Kanal, with help from Mark Hughes and Gary Anderson. Well, Scott, we're right now, Ferrari on top. Going to be a great year for Maranello.
Yep, 2024 is fixed. We have nothing to worry about. It's going to be a great season of fantastic battles, and who knows, maybe Red Bull will even be able to win a race or two as Ferrari canter to the title.
Excellent. That's the upbeat positivity about Ferrari faded immediately there. And we should welcome you, Samarth, because this is your first The Race F1 podcast.
Yeah, it's weird to see where the magic is happening.
Where is the magic happening? Exactly. Please,
should I reveal your location on the? Well, we're in the heady heights of Bahrain. It's spectacular, and I've so much energy from you, Ed, at this time of night. It's brilliant. It's good to see.
I have to sort of ramp myself up for broadcasting, when really I probably just want to go.
Podcast Ed is a very enthusiastic genre of Ed.
Yeah, I'm quite enthusiastic sometimes, and I must say this is quite a good recording time, so I'm quite happy with that. And also means everybody gets to listen to it in good time before day three gets going. But are you excited about Ferrari, given Carlos Sainz was quickest? Are you waving the red flag?
I'm waving the caution flag. I mean,
just the yellow
flag. Does
that
analogy work?
No,
because
it broke down from the start.
Isn't the Ferrari flag technically a red and a yellow flag?
Yeah, so it's the slippery surface one.
That's the one. I was trying to think of that flag. But yeah, I mean, it's day two of testing. Who's going to read into that? Are you guys reading into that too much?
We are absolutely reading into that, and I'll tell you who reads into it more than anyone else and better than anyone else, and that is Mark Hughes. He's been number crunching in his bunker back at base, and he can actually give us perhaps a little bit of reason to find some optimism for Ferrari in terms of his long-run analysis. So let's hear from Mark Hughes.
Day two of testing gives us a slightly more detailed data set to work from than the opening day. And although it was Carlos Sainz's Ferrari at the top of the headline times, what do we find when we delve beneath the surface on a day when Max Verstappen didn't get to drive the Red Bull? The scheduled afternoon appearance cancelled to give Sergio Perez more cockpit time after his morning running was curtailed by the red flag. The pace comparison presupposes, of course, that Red Bull and Ferrari are using the same base weight for their low fuel laps, which may not be the case. But recent history suggests that the two teams actually do run quite a similar fuel load, and we derive this from any variation in how they've qualified in the opening races compared to their calculated pre-season testing performance. And last year in Bahrain qualifying, the gap between the fastest car of those two teams was quite similar to how it had looked in testing. The patterns over the last couple of seasons suggest that Mercedes and McLaren run slightly heavier with their base weights in testing, and Aston Martin slightly lower. That may not necessarily be the case this year, of course, but it's the best we have to go on. There's also considerable variation in their programs, but Red Bull and Ferrari both attempted some form of race simulation, giving us further clues. But let's look first at single lap pace. Everything we've seen so far suggests the new Ferrari is very quick over a lap, just like last year's car, which scored 6 poles amid a season of total Red Bull domination. Carlos Sainz reports that although this car is still something of a lively handful around this track when pushed, it feels less sensitive to the strong winds, which are such a feature here. Watching Alex Albon commented that the top teams seem to be able to switch the wind off compared to how his Williams feels. This is to do with the sensitivity of their downforce in yaw, something which Ferrari technical director Enrico Cardile confirmed was a major target for improvement in the conception of this car. When analysing the single lap pace, we also need to normalise for the tyre compound differences today, because Sainz used a soft C4 tyre, not a tyre which will be used in the race weekend, to set that session heading time, whereas Red Bull, Mercedes and McLaren all stayed with the C3, which will be the allocated soft for the race. How much quicker was the C4 over the C3? Sainz found around 7/10 when he switched, between with the run separated by only around 15 minutes. Later in the day, RB's Daniel Ricciardo made the same switch with only 10 minutes between his last C3 run and his first C4, and he found around 6/10. So if we take that 6/10 tyre boost as a guide, we'd find that Sainz's best lap normalised to give a tyre equivalence to the second fastest Sergio Perez, would still have the Ferrari fastest, albeit only by around 1/10 of a second. But that's over Perez, not Verstappen. Last year, Verstappen qualified around 1/10 and a half faster than Perez here, but his seasonal average was around 3/10 advantage. So if we put a theoretical Verstappen pace advantage over Perez in the equation, it puts the Red Bull narrowly on top by between 0.5 and 1/4 of a second. Equally, we might make an adjustment for the Ferrari, as last year Charles Leclerc averaged 0.18 faster than Sainz. Either way, it looks very close on one lap pace between those two cars, but only on the assumption that Red Bull wasn't disguising its true pace by running heavier or with the less aggressive engine mode. Lewis Hamilton made good progress with the Mercedes in the afternoon, working away it was initially a difficult balance to a much better behaved one, but his best low fuel lap was around 0.5 a second adrift of Sainz's, even allowing for that 6/10 tyre offset. Lando Norris and the McLaren was a further 2/10 off the Mercedes, but with the proviso that both these teams have historically run testing slightly heavier than Red Bull and Ferrari. Daniel Ricciardo's RB was again best of the rest of the big teams, and although his 5th fastest time was aided by that C4 tyre, doing the 6/10 offset still puts him on around the same time as Lance Stroll's Aston Martin. But even if we make an Alonso allowance for the Aston's time, that's still around 0.5 a second off McLaren. Alpine is making progress with a car very different from last year in its traits with that new rear suspension, but run for run in its current state it seemed to be around 1/10 of the RB in the Aston, with Sauber, Williams and Haas following on in that order. So much for one lap pace. The initial long runs paint a slightly different picture. Both Red Bull and Ferrari made race simulation runs at much the same time and using the same combination of C3, C2 and C1 respectively for the 3 stints. In this comparison, the Ferrari looks suspiciously good, with a respective pace suggesting Carlos Sainz would have beaten Sergio Perez by a full minute over a 57 lap distance. We can't believe this is an accurate representation of Red Bull's true pace, but that's what the day 2 numbers say. Let's wait for day 3 to see if this apparent evidence is confirmed or repeated.
So, Scott, some optimism there from Mark about Ferrari's pace. But obviously, it's looking now a bit like it's Red Bull ahead. And really, it's a question of by how much. And then there's that second group that Ferrari's in, McLaren's in, Mercedes seems to be in. It's starting to go from very amorphous to slightly more of a pattern as we move through testing, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't want to undermine what the numbers say, but they... like anything through testing, the numbers offer a snapshot of the day and how that day played out. You then have to apply context, and a lot of the context is missing. We don't know what the two teams were doing with engine modes. We can't be sure what other factors might have played into why certain offsets were as large as they were. I can say from speaking to a lot of people in the paddock that regardless of what the numbers say, the expectation is that Red Bull is in front and potentially in front by quite a reasonable margin. There's a couple of people fearful that it might even be bigger than last year.
And people at Ferrari think that as well, we should add.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at what both the drivers said today, I think Charles Leclerc said that it is, unfortunately, it does look like Red Bull is still quite a bit ahead. Sainz said he wasn't afraid, but said while a personal goal for him is to fight for the championship this year, realistically, if you look at what Red Bull's brought, that isn't or might not be possible. And you speak to different people, you obviously get different estimates, but the one consistent thing across every bit of, not necessarily an outright pecking order, but scoping out the lay of the land, everyone has Red Bull in front. And this isn't just journalists and people don't know. I've spoken to a couple of team bosses, spoken to other insiders within teams. Everyone thinks Red Bull is ahead. They think that they've moved on from last year. It's not just an improvement. They're still the benchmark, and I think everybody expected them to be the benchmark realistically. But it's just, there is just a bit of a wow factor about this car. And while I don't think you'll see it in the lap times over one lap or a stint that Perez did today, there's still a big emphasis on the ease with which Verstappen did his day one lap time, and just a lot of stuff that's emanating from that team, and everything about the car, the way it looks, the way it's driving on track when it's dialed in, and the performance and the reliability is indicating that that is the car to beat by some margin.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess, Samarth, really, it's a question of who's closest, isn't it, to Red Bull, not a question whether they can challenge them at this stage, at least.
And I think the noise from Ferrari is pretty good, and I'm not going to argue with Mark Hughes. You know, the optimism is there, and while it's only day two, Ferrari have done a good job. Now, the battle between them and Mercedes is what we're talking about. Between them, it's splitting hairs at this point. I can't see who's on top there. I don't know what you've gleaned from day two, but the Mercedes really haven't shown their hand, is what I'm thinking.
Yeah, I think McLaren are...
I would throw McLaren
into the
mix,
are there. Yeah. I'm pretty sure McLaren and Ferrari are fairly close, and I think both teams actually think they're fairly close. You're right, though, that Mercedes is a little bit more of a wild card. And in fact, I talk about this a bit with Gary Anderson in the Race Members Club podcast we've recorded about the Mercedes not looking ultra convincing on track. But Scott, George Russell was talking about the improved stability of the car, that rear axle weakness they've improved. So they've made a gain. The car's working quite nicely, but it's not completely... all things are perfect now. There's a lot for them to learn with that car still. And I guess we should perhaps expect them to be a little less dialed in with the car, and that's certainly what it looks like from trackside.
I would say that applies of the teams chasing Red Bull, mostly to Mercedes, certainly, but it also applies to a lesser extent to Ferrari and McLaren, maybe even an Aston Martin type that's hopeful of sort of getting into that fight and sniping at Red Bull or sniping for podiums a little bit. Because while the Mercedes feels like it has the most headroom versus where it is now to where, if it's got everything right, where it could be, because I think it has made the most changes if you could factor in mechanical and aerodynamic. And that's just the stuff we can see as well. Andrea Stella at McLaren has said this a million times, I think, since he became team principal, but said it again this evening when I spoke to him, that this rule set is about millimetres, and the larger stuff that we can see does have an impact, and we'll be bringing a lot of the performance that we've seen on the RB20, but there's a lot of stuff out of sight as well. That will all have changed for every team. And that's the bit that we can't judge the extent of. And it might well be that what Red Bull had in its locker last year, when it wasn't bringing new parts to the track, means that Red Bull has overhauled so much of that car, including maybe the underside of the Red Bull has been overhauled just as much as... I mean, how scary would that be if the floor and everything has been reworked in a way that the side pod has, the engine cover? So it's possible that Red Bull have moved the game on significantly, but theoretically, Mercedes should have the most room to improve, Ferrari should have a decent amount of room to improve as well, and McLaren, given that they're going to be bringing upgrades through the season designed to further improve the weaknesses that they think they've started to address, the knife edge characteristics, the slow speed corner weakness, that kind of thing, there's room kind of for everyone to raise the bar. Mercedes is that one that for me at the moment with that biggest unknown. It's that fascination of both the drivers now are consistent in saying it feels nicer to drive than last year. Hamilton backed it up after his first day in the car. It's really fascinating to see where they can get that car to, because it's all well and good saying that now on the first day or two of testing, but as the fuel comes out, or even as the fuel goes in and they start to do those really long runs, that's when you're going to find those weaknesses, because you'll be putting the car on the limit, whether that's over one lap, pushing it hard when it's lighter, or when you're exposing its weaknesses and deficiencies because you put all the fuel in and you're doing a race run.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And we're still, they're still learning in that regard, and we certainly on the outside still trying to understand that. Somehow there was an interesting bit today. Well, I say an interesting bit today, it was probably the opposite of interesting, when our old friend drain covers arose again, literally.
Oh boy,
did you enjoy that moment?
I think Fernando Alonso did a really good job of dodging it, by the way. I'm just gonna put that out there.
Always happens. It's always Alonso dodging it. And then a Ferrari hits it.
I don't think he's ever seen a drain. And, you know, I think it's just bad luck. There's some conspiracy theories going around about drains hating Ferrari, or maybe vice versa. It was an unfortunate incident. And, you know, I'm glad they took the time to fix it. Let's just say that.
At some points, though, as many as 16 people circled around that hole.
I was about to ask.
They had angle, multiple angle grinders were there. They had the welding kit. They had a roll of duct tape, which I was very reassured to see. It wasn't used, but I was pleased it was there. I was standing helpfully a few metres away watching them and taking photos, which they enjoyed very much. And Gary was shouting some encouragement as well. And they had a leaf blower.
You seem to know an awful lot about this and seem to be awfully excited about the drain cover coming loose. Did you have any role to play in the drain cover coming loose?
Were you
trying to inject some life into the morning of testing?
I don't think I was. It was just after 12, I think, the drain cover lifted.
Were you trying to inject some life into the early afternoon of testing?
More accurate, yes. Although, technically speaking, that was the morning session, and then it was the afternoon session.
So were you trying to inject some life into the morning session of testing?
This could run and run, unlike the session at that particular point. But yeah, it was just, because we were watching myself and Gary Anderson at turn 11 at that point. Actually, we were around at the exit of turn 11, and this was on the run into it. But it's funny, because I'd just taken a photo of Leclerc to send into our live coverage, saying, oh, he's using a lot of the track width on entry. And then I don't think that was the lap he hit it. I think it was the next lap round he hit it. I'm not 100% sure, but it was certainly a similar sort of time. But I don't think he was the only one doing that and lifting it. So, it's amazing how often that happens, though, isn't it? That these drain problems seem to be happening with greater frequency.
It's terrifying as well. Whenever it happens, it's genuinely terrifying, as we saw in Vegas, I think. On the race live coverage, they did ask, is Ed psychic? So I'm starting to wonder now, maybe you are the reason the drain covers keep flying off.
Well, exactly. And people can find out if I'm psychic when I do a range of psychic shows touring around the UK in the next off season as a lucrative sideline. I can do a few cold readings, I'm sure, and get a few quid off people. But no, I'm not actually going to be doing that. But anyway, yeah, it's just another one of those things. And it was quite a long delay, and they did a good job of repairing it. And I have to offer this detail because I was there watching it, but it was the big problem was it was sort of those long narrow drains that was running down the sort of side of the curb, and when it had lifted, it had taken some of the kind of edging that it sits in. So it's not just a hole with a cover on top of it. It's got to have something, obviously, to support it. And they were having to repair that. I think they did a pretty good job. I sort of mocked the fact there were 16 of them standing around it at times. Three of them seemed to be doing the work, but eventually they got it there and there were no more problems. So it happens. I can't remember that sort of thing happening here in recent years. So
reminder of the fact that it can happen at a quote-unquote proper circuit.
Yeah.
Because obviously Vegas came in for a lot of criticism. F1 and the FIA came in for a lot of criticism there. And the last time it had happened, I think, would have been Azerbaijan, which was another street track. But before that, it was Sepang. When the Haas hit it. And I think it's easy for that to get kind of overlooked sometimes. I understand why people say, oh, this shouldn't happen, blah, blah, blah. How was it possible? But it is. Like, it just is, isn't it? And I think if you look at that range of circuits that we've seen it now in recent years, Sepang, Baku, Vegas, Bahrain, it's quite a wide range there in terms of age, in terms of regularity of use, in terms of maintenance, in terms of how long it's been since it was inspected or whatever. So, yeah, it can literally happen at any time. The one thing that would potentially help with avoiding it is, like, you could argue that being hit on this occasion wasn't quite as egregious as Sainz hitting it in Vegas, because Sainz drove over something that was in the middle of the track, and I think Leclerc kind of sort of basically had to go half off track to hit this one. It raises the question of whether the driver should be allowed to use that bit of track. You know, if that curb was raised, would it stop anyone going out there and hitting this this kind of thing, but obviously that's a separate issue altogether.
Genuine question, is the ground effect era going to exacerbate that problem with the vacuum under the car?
I suspect it's exerting a little bit more lift, yeah, potentially. It could well be that could be playing a part, and yeah, that's just one of the unintended consequences of these rules. But at the same time, even you always had ground effect under these cars before as well. It's just not quite as powerful. So I'm not sure how big an effect it is. But yeah, it's just one of those things. And to their credit, obviously they stopped running. They had an early lunch break and they did a good job to fix it. And there were no problems afterwards. These things can't be just magically fixed. So they did do a good job. And yeah, it was good to get a good afternoon of running in. And before we move on to hearing from our F1 technical expert, Gary Anderson, let me remind you about our great The Race Members Club offer. If you love this podcast and want extra audio content, as well as loads of other things like early access to Bring Back V10s and an ad-free web environment, then The Race Members Club is definitely for you. Right now, for a strictly limited period, you can get a month's membership for free. And after that, the normal monthly price is just $2.99, which we hope you'll find fantastic value. Loads of good stuff planned over the coming months. And there's a lot of stuff in the archive for you to dig into as well, including a recent members-only Q&A and a podcast I'm also recording today with Gary Anderson with Trackside Observations. So to sign up today, click the link in the description to this episode.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Well, I'm joined now by Gary Anderson. We're not long back from the circuit. What was catching your eye today technically? You were able to look at the cars again, study some photos, took a quite deep look at the RB. So is that a car that you're particularly concerned about? There's lots of suggestions it might be a Red Bull clone.
I'm not concerned about it, no. I mean, there's a lot of discussion about it in the pit lane about how close it is to last year's Red Bull. You know, is it a clone? Is it a copy? Have they got information that they shouldn't have? I mean, the regulations are pretty black and white on it as far as what you can use of somebody else's and what you can't use of somebody else's.
Basically, you have to do your own aero, yeah, and everything else, give or take, is fair game. You've got to do your own monocoque. But basically, the aero is the absolute key thing you can't copy. Yeah.
Well, you know, the monocoque is a major aerodynamic part of the car. So really what you see, you got to do yourself. The upright assemblies, the wishbones, the gearbox, hydraulic system, and lots of that sort of mechanical stuff, which really and truthfully is something that can let you down, but it doesn't play a big role in making you go faster. You know, you obviously, we talk a lot this last couple of years about platform control and how the suspension geometries and the anti-dive and anti-lifts all work to try and control that aerodynamic platform. That's all part of the suspension. But it's pretty black and white as to what you can use from what the RB can use from Red Bull, and what they have to do themselves. And I went through it in quite detail today, you know, and looked at the car as a visual aerodynamic concept. And I think your car is, you know, it's different in every way. You start at the front wing, it's a completely different span-wise loading, which then affects the floor, the leading edge of the floor differently. Yeah, and it all starts there. You know, that's the first part of the flow. With the flow coming off the front wing, the rest of the car has to cope with. And then you go through into the side poles and that. And they are, you know, like nearly every other team, they are a follow-on from Red Bull in 2023. Nothing wrong with that. It looked pretty successful, the Red Bull in 2023, to me. So you would take a fair amount of visual input from it, as every other team has done. So I see nothing more... sort of Red Bullish on their car than I do on anybody else's car. So I wouldn't worry about it whatsoever. I'd say it's good job, well done. And financially, for both Red Bull and for RB, you know, it's financially better for them to share those mechanical components, because why do it all yourself? And the big thing about that is, as well, like most other teams that, that share stuff, even Aston Martin, for example, they have the gearbox and rear end of Mercedes. It ups the size of your team, because while you haven't got people designing that, you don't need them, because you're buying it in from somebody else. It doesn't really necessarily save you loads of money, because you're not paying those people, but it does mean that your team gets a little bit bigger. You don't have so much to do. So it's a positive thing for a small team. At the end of the day, whenever they come to actually challenging Red Bull for race wins, might be a different story down the pit lane then, but we'll... they're not ready for that yet.
Well, that's what Christian Horner was saying. He wants them to be a competitor for them. But the car looked pretty good on track. You can hear a little bit more about our trackside impressions from the special podcast we've recorded for the Race Members Club, based on what we've seen today and yesterday. But also, technically, Gary, you're having a look at the Mercedes front wing. As you originally said when we talked about the car at launch, you were happy it was legal. I agreed on that, having looked at the regs, and... it just is legal. Now you've seen the thing up close.
Yep.
It's absolutely fine, isn't it? And it's all about the way they've configured it. There's I think three rules you picked out that that it had to comply with, and it does.
Yes, and even without that little strip that they've got attached to the, let's say, the third element and close to the nose, I think it's still legal as well, because, you know, it says it's a maximum of four elements. And that's fine. They have got four outboard, but they got three inboard. So, you know, maximum to me means that you can't have more than four, but it doesn't say you can't have three or two or one if you want to. So it'll be interesting to see, because there is a chance that you could take it a lot further, which obviously might be the sort of... it might have opened the door here for someone else. Which I think the FIA and Formula One, Pat Simmons and that, who wrote these is responsible for these regulations, might sort of close down a little bit on it, the intention of the rule. But it's you know, it's still, in my book, the rules are the rules. The rules are what's written. The teams read them, and it's their responsibility to find the grey areas and try and exploit them. And this is one of those little bits of grey areas. But as I say, it could be putting your foot in the door just to try to see what you can get away with. And on speaking to some of the people at Mercedes, they would like to not have that inner part of the wing. So, as I say, I think it would be good to see the rules tightened up a little bit, I suppose you might call it, in that area, just to sort of make sure that the intention of the rules, which was to not generate this, what we used to call a Y250 vortex, where you had quite a big change in the wing from a certain distance.
It's 250 millimetres either side of the centre point, isn't it? Hence Y250.
But, I mean, that all came about by the regulations. The regulations wanted better, clear airflow to the underneath of the car, so that you only allowed one element underneath in that section at 250 from car centreline. And then whenever the teams put the flaps on there, they found they could generate this vortex, which washed away the wake from the front wheel. And that hurt cars that were coming up beside other cars, you know, in traffic. You lost huge amounts of downforce. So, you know, sometimes you can shoot yourself in the foot. In that case, the FIA did shoot themselves in the foot by bringing in that regulation. It was there for years, but now they're worried about going back there. And, you know, as I say, this, to me, the Mercedes thing could be a step in that direction. But I think, as far as the rules are concerned, in my opinion, it's fully legal. And it would be fully legal with less elements in there even.
What else has been catching your eye? You spent a bit of time studying the front wings. It's a bit of a work in progress for a piece we'll likely run on the website. But are you seeing much variation in the front wing approach? And what can you discern from the fact there is that variation?
Well, you know, I've got my own beliefs as to what route I'd be taking if I was designing a car. And I'm not sitting here and saying that I designed it like a Red Bull, because Red Bull's quick. I'm sitting here saying that I can understand the way the Red Bull load up the front wing. You know, they load it up from the inboard end, and it span-wise, the loading diminishes as it goes outwards. because the last thing you want to do is have a lot of load right in front of that front tire, because the front wheel has a movable thing. You know, when you get run it accordingly, the first thing you do is steer the car, and that moves that front wheel across the wing. So if you've got that area working hard, it will change. And the last thing you need to do is to end up changing the balance of the car just with steering lock. Or you want to change the balance of the car with steering lock because you want the centre pressure to go forward if you can. But by having the wing loaded up there, there's a very good chance you'll actually reduce the front load with steering lock. So I think that the least you can do with it in front of the front tyre, the more consistent you'll be with your setup, with your air, your centre pressure parameters that you're trying to control. And the Red Bull and a few other cars, the Ferrari, they all, to me, look, yep, they're following that path. Not just completely, but they are following that path quite decently. And then you get other cars that are not following that path, that have got complex trailing edges, I suppose you might call it, on the front wing. Which means that when you have that and you're loading up a certain part of the span of the wing, more than the other parts of the span of the wing, you get transverse flow. So the flow always gets pulled to the hardest working part because it wants to get fed from somewhere. It can't take enough through the throat of the wing. So you get a lot of transverse flow, and that transverse flow then affects the underfloor. So you sort of, again, it's like a driver, you know, you can create your own problems, and then you spend a lot of time trying to solve them. So that's really what I'm looking at whenever I look at this front wing assembly and the suspension behind it, because that's the area of the car for me that defines the flow structure that the rest of the car can do something with. And I think you've got to get that right before you can get the rest of it right.
And of course, the front wheel wake is so complicated. It's why the aerodynamics of open wheel racing cars are so difficult, because there's so many moving parts there, yeah. And of course, well, so much trouble.
Yeah, I mean, a rotating wheel even causes trouble. But whenever you've got a rotating wheel that's steered as well, the wake coming off that front tyre, I mean, quite a few years ago, people would go, you know, haywire whenever the tyre company wanted to change the sort of profile of the sidewall of the tyre by a little bit. And nowadays, that's good. It's constant because Pirelli are Pirelli, and their tyre just stays there, just stays the same. It's all good stuff. But then you imagine putting steering lock onto it, varying from zero going down the straight, which obviously I've never met a driver who complains about understeer going down the straight yet. But, you know, you go from that to, in a normal track, up to something like 10 or 12 degrees of steering lock, you know, road wheel steering lock. Monaco through Lowe's Hairpin, you know, you go up to like 20 degrees, but that's only one corner in the season. So you really got to cope with zero straight ahead, in other words, to get the maximum you can for braking through the stages to like 12 degrees. We used to simulate steering lock at stages of 0, 3 degrees, 6 degrees, 9 degrees, and 12 degrees, and try and be able to plot the centre pressure change through that period, because 12 degrees is a low speed corner, you know, 3 degrees is a very high speed corner, and the other two are in between there somewhere. So you got to cater for all that. And you've got to cater for all that with the tools that you can. And it's only that you have aerodynamically to move the centre of pressure to suit what you want in those different sets of parameters. So that's one of your tools in your toolbox from a design point of view to get right. And it's also one of the tools in the toolbox you don't want to get wrong, you know, because it's no good if you went and put a screw in the wall, picking out a smoothing plane. You need a screwdriver. And so you've got certain things on the car that you can play with and do things with from a sort of concept point of view. And the steering angle relative to centre pressure is the one you have. And you have to make that work for you, not against you.
Yeah, and that's an area of huge focus for these teams. But great to get your insights on the evolving tech of these cars. You'll be spending some more time prowling in the pit lane tomorrow to get a close look. And I'm sure we'll hear plenty from you again about the detail of these 2024 F1 cars. So thank you, Gary. We'll get back to the pod in a moment. But first, a word about our partner, Grammarly. No matter what kind of work you do, how you communicate is key. All those emails, reports, and presentations are equally important to the collaboration needed to get things done. And Grammarly can help.
Grammarly is your AI writing partner to help you communicate more effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact at work. I know from experience that Grammarly can help you save time on any writing task and ensure you feel confident about what you've produced. In fact, 96% of Grammarly's users report that Grammarly helps them craft more impactful writing, and their tone suggestions can help you navigate even the most difficult work conversations. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Sign up and download for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
I'm back now with Scott and Samarth. Gary talked in depth about why the RB isn't just an RB19 copy technically, but can you explain why the whole AB team thing and complaints about Red Bull was a big talking point today? And I should add, you're going to need to take your mind off the phone you've just dropped and look very forlorn about. I'll leave you to... Where's it fallen? You're sat on the sofa.
It's down the side of the sofa, because I think this is actually a sofa bed. And I wasn't forlorn. I'll get the phone in a bit. I've just felt bad because I feared that I'd ruined your excellent take introducing the next segment of the podcast. I felt bad. I'm sorry.
Oh, just a little bit of background knowledge, but you're forgiven. Just don't do it again. Don't drop anything else.
Thank you. Okay, so on this, it's interesting to me because Zak Brown at McLaren has been going on about team collaborations for a very long time. As far as I can tell, it goes back to sort of early 2021. Where this has been quite a prominent issue for him, but it's definitely become bigger in recent months, and he's become a lot more vocal about it. And that is partly because the argument that he's making has evolved. It's not just about team relationships, that kind of AB team in terms of supply deals and, you know, voting in packs and following, going against your own interest as a smaller team to vote in the way that the A team is telling you to vote. So Haas and Ferrari, for example, Red Bull and Red Bull 2, any other relationship that I've forgotten about, Mercedes and Williams back in the day, or because I don't think it works quite that way now, but that's how it was perceived certainly a few years ago.
Well, there always used to be political alliance. I remember there were complaints because McLaren and Tyrrell were working quite close together on the political landscape. It was just a thing that happens.
Yeah, so it's not just that anymore. Zak is making a very large amount of noise consistently now because he's very, very unhappy about the fact that there is one entity on the grid, or one entity that owns two teams on the grid. He doesn't like dual team ownership. And I, from a basic point of view, like, I see where he's coming from. I don't think in a closed shop like as F1 has clearly become, this so-called franchise model that we're all meant to believe in, I don't think it's good. From a variety point of view, 10 independent teams is better than 9 independent teams and a second team owned by another one. Just from an integrity point of view and an optics point of view, I think it's just better just to have pure independence between all of the teams. And what I can't quite put my finger on at the moment is what has happened, or what Zak fears will happen to make this such a prominent issue now. I can only assume it's because we're getting really into the thick of Concorde negotiations, and he wants this to be really rubber stamped for 2026 onwards in the rules for collaborations, what you can do as a constructor, what you can take from another team, but also in F1's governance itself. So that's why I asked Zak that in the press conference today, and then as Christian Horner was in the press conference with him, I also asked for him and Lauren Mekies, the RB team principal, who was there as well, for their response. I wanted to give them the right of reply to whatever it was Zak said, and it was both sides made their points of view quite clear, didn't they?
Yeah, clear.
I didn't say they made a good argument.
Yeah,
they made their points clear.
I completely agree that from a perspective of sporting integrity, you need to avoid dual ownership. So I think that's something that for the future, I think in the 26 Concorde, it shouldn't be allowed. And that needs to just to be locked down. Now, Red Bull has had this second team for a long time. And I do think that as part of that, it has to be grandfathered in that they're allowed to keep hold of the two. But what I want to see is quietly in the background, Bernie Eccleston style, find a way to encourage them to sell for a good, fair price. And they could sell that for a lot. And just solve the problem that way. You can't just ban Red Bull from owning that team just like that. That's not fair. And the trouble is, because this argument, as Zach made it, and I think fundamentally he's correct, but there's all these sort of suggestions about excessive collaboration between Red Bull and RB that I don't think's there now. I don't think that's a problem still. As Gary Anderson talked about, the car is very different still. So that's not an issue for me.
Pretty it much could, every aero surface, which they have to do themselves, yep. You can find differences in.
Exactly. So I think it becomes easier to defend when, as Christian Horner did, you can then say, well, they go their own way, they've got different personnel, different culture, this, that, and the other. And it also makes it easier for Christian Horner to at length come up with a completely pointless counter argument to the key point about dual ownership, which is, oh, Red Bull's was begged to buy, we were begged to buy this team back in the day by FIA and Bernie Eccleston.
So we said they've done so much for F1, and but his argument was basically we should be grateful for Red Bull, not trying to undermine them.
Yeah, but I think, and I've written about this on the race website, and this is the reason why I've tried to say, look, this isn't actually about the two Red Bull teams. It's just the principle that needs to be dealt with. So I do agree, but it was inevitable this was going to become more of a problem. They've obliterated the identity of their second team and called it RB. So they've done a spectacular own goal there, because all their signalling says it's just a vassal team, which is just stupid on their part. So I understand why it's becoming a bit more of a thing again, and they could go too far at some point in the future. And I think it's fair to... It's understandable that Zak Brown's maybe a little bit concerned about that. But for me, it needs to take a step back a little bit, deal with the wider thing, gently encourage RB to be sold down the line, could be in a few years. And I think that's a better solution rather than this more confrontational approach.
But one of the problems as well is that when Zak makes his argument, and I agree with you, and to a point, I agree with him, like I said, with that dual ownership. But when he risks conflating the two and the collaboration and the ownership, that's where it becomes a problem, because he made his case, and at the end of it, he even said, regarding the sharing of parts, he's like, oh, obviously that everything they're doing is within the rules. And as soon as you say that, as much as a lot of the other stuff makes sense, a lot of people will just hear you saying they're actually doing everything that they're allowed to do. I'm just annoyed that this is allowed to happen. And then the nuance of your point, and as you said, that subtle principle behind it is lost, and it just becomes one team moaning about another team.
And when does it blend into the other teams? Haas and Ferrari, I mean, even Aston Martin uses some rear components from Mercedes. So where do you draw that line? It is a grey area after a while.
Well, you need to be careful if you're McLaren, because if you want to go down the pure constructor route, they need to start building their own engines.
Well, yeah. No, you can make that argument. Obviously, you don't complete... Because there are, again, it's two issues. It's the dual ownership or the multiple ownership, not just of complete controlling stakes, but also minority ownerships. You could have an outside entity buying.
It's Sauber.
It's a multiple team, or whatever. Yeah, so that's one thing. You then got the extent of team collaborations, which is actually another debate. So there's a lot of things going on here, but it's dangerous to conflate them all, because then it makes it very easy for Christian Horner to defend it, because he's defending something that's slightly lost the point of its criticism, because the problem is not what Red Bull and RB are doing at the moment. That they're fine, that's not really the issue. So anyway, we've hopefully sort of explained that reasonably well. Should we talk a bit about Haas, because old Scott's got a point
on the subject of Horner and other people being in the press conference? Obviously, him being on official media duty today was we spoke on the day one podcast that he was spotted at the track, and he is here just like he was at the launch. He's front and center of the team. He's still in his role while this investigation goes on into allegations about him in the background. So that meant that he was going to be in the press conferences. He was Red Bull's team representative for the team principals portion of it today. And nothing really to report. All of the stuff that we said on the day one podcast is still valid. Horner was asked a couple of specific questions about the process. One that was a bit more sort of harder at him and his position in it, which was along the lines of how we can take the investigation seriously when he's still in his role, which you could tell from sort of Horner's like reaction to the question, the tone of his voice, and the way he kind of wore his response to the question, that he didn't particularly appreciate the question, and he dismissed it with quite a cold no comment. And he got asked immediately afterwards another question which related to the timeline, which people might be interested to know if there is a rough time for when it'll be resolved. Horner didn't give one. He gave another no comment, but he clearly didn't object to that question in principle as much as the first one, because the tone and manner of the answer was a little less dismissive and icy. So nothing new from Horner himself. The main thing about that whole thing in the press conference today was it was kind of a visual visual representation of the stuff that we've talked about. I think we've talked about it where people can listen, but we've also talked about it amongst ourselves, about that kind of, this is what's going to happen if he's in that public-facing role while it's all going on. You just have that slightly awkward contrast of very public role, very big issue, but he can't talk about it publicly. And it just creates this kind of sideshow while the testing's going on, the team's about to start its preseason. So, yeah, nothing massively new. We still await an outcome from that. It hasn't changed, but he's appeared. He's still sticking by that strategy we've talked about before, and I imagine that'll be the case until this is resolved either way.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk now about Haas, Tamar, because you've been following them a little bit today. They were slowest. So is everything terrible at Haas?
Well, no. There was really good noise coming out of Haas today. Ayo Komatsu was happy. He wasn't thrilled. He wasn't getting overexcited, in his own words. He said that basically Haas got 85 to 90% of what they wanted to get right. They've been focusing on long runs and trying to ditch the tire issues that were plaguing them last year. That's why we saw nothing spectacular for them. And that's good. Maybe we'll see something fun at happy hour, because you can tell, especially with Kevin Magnussen, that he wants to get out and set a really fast lap and get his, you know, qualifying brain in engaged. But they were really focusing on just getting those bugs ironed out today, and Komatsu was really happy with it. I think they have made a bit of a step. I'm unsure as to how much they can compete with the rest of the midfield. It's going to be really hard for them. We know infrastructure-wise, they're probably not at the same level as some of the midfield teams. But it's all relative in F1, and they've made a relatively good step.
What was Nico Hülkenberg like? Because obviously, when we said on the podcast yesterday, didn't we, Magnussen was kind of quite pleased with how Haas was going about things under Komatsu's leadership. Hülkenberg is a bit more of a... bit more of a prickly character sometimes if he doesn't like the question you ask, or doesn't just care about really talking about it, especially in, because you'd have spoken to Hülkenberg the way I did Magnussen yesterday, which was one of the back of the garage, because he's just done TV. It's basically much easier to still be in TV mode and bat away questions you don't like, whereas when you're in the kind of media roundtable, it's a bit more relaxed and forthcoming. So what was Hulk's take on things?
I do always wonder that about Nico Hülkenberg. What kind of mood am I going to catch him in? And today in the desert heat, I will say he was a bit prickly, like a cactus. but he was still a bit optimistic about, you know, the way Haas have ironed out those little creases and issues. He wasn't as over the moon. That's not fair. Ayo Komatsu wasn't over the moon. He was very measured in saying that they've made some steps up. But it didn't seem like he was totally thrilled. Now, that might have been because of the drain cover fiasco and the fact that it was kind of baking hot in the middle of the day. But at the same time, yeah, there is a lot of work to do at Haas still. And he did admit that, in all fairness. It might be tough for them to kind of compete with the rest of the midfield. It'll take time.
I do think their drivers are in quite different positions, aren't they? Because Magnussen is... Magnussen's a little bit kind of like tied to that team. I feel like whatever future Magnussen still has in F1 is basically going to be whether Haas keeps him or not. I got the impression last year that Hülkenberg was like grateful for the opportunity at Haas for as long as he basically put him in the shop window, which was pretty much one race weekend. And then I just got the impression Hülkenberg quite quickly thought, I kind of need to move beyond this, because I'm back. I'm good enough. I want more than this, and I might be of interest to some other teams. So just... that could play out quite interestingly this year. I think Magnussen could quite easily end up playing the team game a little bit more, because he thinks that'll sort of keep him on longer term. And Hülkenberg could end up with a bit of a, well, I'm too good for this, and start to get a bit prickly, as we've said before.
I think the encouraging thing is one of the, well, probably the main problem they had in terms of the tyre deg was an aero one last year. I think there was some little aero dropouts, some little stalls at the rear of the car, that kind of thing. And so I did ask Andrea Desordo, their new technical director, who was their chief designer earlier today, is the car more aerodynamically consistent and stable? Is that a step forward? He said, yeah, that was an objective, and from what we've seen, it is. So that's quite encouraging. And in fact, trackside, that Haas looks pretty decent, pretty consistent, pretty nice. Doesn't look stunningly fast, but it basically looks like a good, slightly slow car, as opposed to a bad, slightly slow car.
Is it looking a little bit like Sauber last year, start of last year?
A little bit, yeah. Because I remember nice, this, but yeah.
Yeah, because I just remember we watched in different places last year, and then that car, we both kind of described it as it doesn't have any obvious vices, but it just never wows and it comes past. And I just got the impression from the way you talked about seeing the Haas that it's kind of ticking the same boxes.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it looks absolutely fine. I think we're kind of shaping up to have a back group that Haas is. I don't think they're cast off the back of it. They'll be in it. Williams showed some promise, but they're sort of still in that area. Sauber.
I think Alpine's in it as well.
Alpine seem to be struggling a bit. They say there's a lot to learn. They're focusing on all the plans and that, run plans and that kind of thing. But they're and understanding the suspension changes. But the car at no point trackside has looked anything more than kind of a back group car, insofar as Bruno Fama talked about it and said, well, we're going to be in the middle somewhere. And I did sort of say to him, it looks like you're going to be sort of lower middle at best. But they're really looking longer term anyway. They're managing expectations. So they seem relatively content with things. But I don't think that Alpine's going to be tearing up any trees at the moment. But yeah, very much. I think Haas is in that back group, not in its own little 2021 style class of its own, nowhere.
No, it's interesting to see how that plays out. I was I had a brief chat with James Vowles at Williams during the day, a little bit of a catch up just to see how they were getting on relative to day one and the setback with the mileage. And he sort of said it's been calmer insofar as they've been able to get more work done, but you'd never make up what you lose on a. And it wasn't a disastrous first day, but it was obviously probably half the mileage that they wanted, really. They're encouraged by sort of similar to Haas in terms of like they've actually checked off quite a bit of their to-do list with what they were hoping the new car would bring versus what they were expecting in simulation. Obviously, we've talked a lot about the Williams characteristics, the sort of spiteful car traits, and Williams feel like actually what they've seen now over these 2 days of testing, that it's matching what they see on the sim, which is that those car traits are better. They're even hoping that they might be able to turn some of those weaknesses into strengths, which would be proof of serious progress. But they're still not. Vowles wasn't talking at it. It's just like, and that's it. Now we're leaving that back group behind. He's very much kind of, that's where we are, in that cluster of four cars where there's probably a few temps in it maximum, and it'll come down to driver and team execution who gets out of Q1. But I think it is those four at the back. I have a feeling that RB is out of it. And what I don't know is whether they're going to be in the Alpine role of last year, where they're in no man's land between a big fight in the top 10 and the backmarkers, and they're just sort of floating between sort of a mid Q2 position and Q3 top 10 every now and then. Or if they're going to be latched onto that, the tail end of that, not lead group, but the best of the rest group.
Yeah, they're certainly pushing on ahead of that back group, it looks like anyway. So yeah, we'll get a little bit more of an idea tomorrow, obviously, and then we'll be into the Bahrain Grand Prix weekend. That'll give us some answers. So hopefully we've been able to give you a little bit of an idea of what's going on here in Bahrain. Thanks very much to Scott and Samarth for your insight. Well, that brings us to an end of our look back at day two in Bahrain. Head to therace.com for lots more analysis. Sign up to that members club offer I mentioned earlier on. Otherwise, we'll be back with you tomorrow with everything you need to know from the world of F1 testing.
The Athletic.